Going to get started. My name is James Corcoran. I'm an attorney with the Department of Energy Resources. I'll be reading an opening statement. So, it now being about 10 a.m. or thereabouts on August 7th, 2017, in accordance with public notice issued by the Massachusetts Department of Energy Resources, the department hereby opens the public hearing on proposed amendments to portions of 225 CMR 16 Alternative Energy Portfolio Standard, or APS. This is the final public hearing that the DOER will hold on the proposed Alternative Energy Portfolio Standards. As explained by the public notice, the APS regulations require all retail electricity suppliers selling electricity to end-use customers in the Commonwealth to obtain a specific minimum percentage of their electricity supply from alternative energy generation sources. The proposed amendments make revisions in response to public comments to allow renewable thermal generation units to qualify for the APS program, as required by Chapter 251 of the Acts of 2014, now codified at MGL Chapter 25A, Section 11F and 1/2. The proposed amendments also make revisions to allow fuel cell and waste-to-energy thermal generation units to qualify for the APS program, as required by Sections 3, 4, 17 of Chapter 188 of the Acts of 2016, now codified at MGL Chapter 25A, Section 11F and 1/2. The purpose of this public hearing is to receive verbal and written comments on the proposed APS program regulations. As indicated in the public notice, written testimony will be accepted until 5 p.m. on August 7, 2017, which is today. This public hearing is being recorded, and the department requests that, to the extent possible, parties also submit written copies of their testimony. We'll now proceed with the comments in the order on the sign-in sheet.
Michael. Hi, everyone. I'm Mike Judge. I'm the director of the Renewable Energy Division at the Department of Energy Resources. So we're just going to go down the line quick, have everyone introduce themselves that's here from DOER, and then we'll begin.
Yeah, Eric Stelzer. I'm the deputy director in the Renewables Division.
Samantha Mazur, I'm the Renewable Thermal Program Coordinator.
My name is John Parrott. I'm a forester and a Renewable Thermal Program Coordinator as well.
My name is Dave Lutz. I'm a Program Coordinator with the division.
All right, so we have about 38 people signed up as of right now to testify. So with that, we're going to impose a time limit so that everyone gets an opportunity to speak within the two-hour period here. So we're going to have 3 minutes for each person that comes up and testifies. And the first person we have on the list is Nathan Latoile. And Nathan, I understand if you want to come up together, that's fine.
Yeah, okay, thank you. We need the microphone, do we? Just
no, you don't need it. Just speak up. Yep.
Good morning. My name is Nathan Latoile, and I'm the executive director of the Natural Forest Alliance. I'm joined here today by our president, Charlie Thompson, and I think we have a few members here who may be testifying as well. The Mass Forest Alliance is a not-for-profit trade group that represents foresters, landowners, wood producers, and others who advocate for a strong and sustainable forest economy. I appreciate the opportunity to comment on these revised regulations and guidelines. There have been some major improvements in the most recent changes, most notably the attempts to focus more on the stack emissions and the efficiency of qualifying woody biomass systems, and less on things like fuel moisture level. The remaining areas of concern that have gone unaddressed, as well as some new areas of concern with recent changes. While we know that DOER's primary focus is on producing clean energy, MFA is excited about the opportunity provided by the APS to assist with improving air quality in Massachusetts. While it's likely that eligible woody biomass systems incentivized by these standards will replace heating systems that run on fossil fuels, such as oil and propane, it's even more likely that they'll replace existing, older, less efficient wood heating systems. The leaps in wood heating technologies that have been made in the last decade and those that we anticipate in the near future are impressive. As the price of these systems fall and the ease of operation and efficiency increases, the prevalence of older wood systems will diminish and the stigma of wood burning will fade. While there is much debate about the accuracy of the air quality data that's used to compare Massachusetts to its neighboring states, there's no doubt that wood biomass heating systems that meet the requirements proposed in these regulations will not only displace dirty fossil fuels, but will also replace much of the existing infrastructure of older wood-burning systems. The requirements of the APS for systems to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in order to receive credits guarantees that they will not replace clean systems with dirty. What we install, whatever the technology is, will be clean, efficient, and help the Commonwealth achieve its greenhouse gas reduction goals. MFA, its predecessor organizations, and many of our members individually have long been involved in discussions of renewable energy policy in the Commonwealth. While we're as eager as anyone to see these regulations and guidelines finalized, we also urge DOER to take the necessary time to get it right and maximize the potential for a thermal energy incentive to advance energy diversification, address the challenges posed by greenhouse gas levels, and sustain forests, which provide much to the residents of our state. I've submitted in-depth written testimony on behalf of MFA to the agency, but would like to briefly touch on a few major items included in our testimony now. MFA strongly disagrees with the removal of pre-minting as an option for small woody biomass systems. This simple change almost entirely reduces the likelihood of such systems being installed. Without the upfront money to reduce the substantial initial capital cost of these systems, their adoption is doubtful. MFA has asked for either a set-aside for those technologies being pushed the hardest to improve or a per-technology cap that complies with the legislative intent to ensure that all technologies are given equal access to compete for credits. MFA is suggesting several reasonable and logical changes to the distinction between thinnings and residues as they're used in the regulations. Currently, their usage just doesn't line up with either silviculture or on-the-ground forestry. MFA also remains doubtful that the statutory requirement for all biomass systems to be low-emission, use energy-efficient conversion technologies, and use fuel that's produced by means of sustainable forestry practices has been met. As written, biomass systems are required to meet the first two, but not the third requirement. This should be addressed before final regulations are released. Finally, while MFA has drawn attention in our written comments to various flaws in the regulations and suggested proposals to fix these, we're happy to participate in the future discussions among stakeholders and regulators to clarify our perspectives and to work as we move forward. Thank you for your time today. And Charlie Thompson, our president, is going to.
Thank you. I'm old enough to remember the original FedEx commercials with the fast-talking guy. So try to get this in 3 minutes. My name is Charlie Thompson. I'm president of the Mass Forest Alliance. Nathan said what it is. I live in Hampshire County. I'm a forester by profession. And I'm licensed in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Vermont as a forester. My wife and I own 2 woodlots in Massachusetts, a third in Vermont. My tenure of ownership on these 3 woodlots is 49, 39, and 20 years, respectively. I own and manage them for a variety of reasons, but probably the most important is that I love being able to spend lots of time in the woods. I suspect that there are a couple of things that everybody in this room agrees upon today. One is that forests are essential for the survival and welfare of the human race and the only planet that we so far inhabit. And that forests will play an essential role in dealing with climate change. Beyond that, I'm very certain that there are a lot of differences among us. But if we agree that retaining a lot of forest is a good thing, I want to talk a bit about that and how it relates to the proposed alternative portfolio standard regulations. As Nathan said, our detailed and technical comments were submitted in writing separately. Many landowners, and me among them, need to be able to produce periodic income from their woods to afford continued ownership of the land. To do that, there need to be markets for the great variety of species and grades of wood that come from our natural, mixed-species, self-regenerating forests. Recent dramatic changes in global supply and demand for products that are made from low-value pulpwood mean that markets for low-value wood are severely stressed. In the last decade, demand for pulpwood in Maine has plunged by 4 million tons annually. Why does this matter to you? If you don't care about people losing jobs and the vigor of rural economies, and I wish you would, maybe you care about the loss of forests that is the inevitable consequence of loss of demand for low-value wood. A lot of woodland owners need their woodland to be at least marginally economically viable. So how does the recognition of wood as renewable fuel by the APS fit in? First of all, it's renewable and abundant. The ratio of forest growth to forest harvest in Massachusetts is high, which means that forest is accumulating in our forests at a rate that far exceeds the rate at which it's being harvested. Second, wood's a local fuel insulated from many of the shocks and disruptions associated with fossil fuel supply. As a local fuel, it diversifies the energy mix, adds to regional energy security, also keeps dollars local, and creates jobs. Third, while oil and gas are very cheap right now, they won't always be. Homeowners, schools, places of worship, municipal buildings, housing complexes, and hospitals can save a lot of money by switching to wood. And there are already many more installations in Massachusetts than you may realize, with the potential for very significant growth. Fourth, there have been technological developments in modern wood heating systems that have dramatically improved efficiency and reduced emissions. Aside from the opportunity to switch systems from fossil to renewable fuel, there are big opportunities.
Charlie, I don't want to just if you could
wrap
up a little bit. Yeah, sorry.
Credits offered to the APS needed to accelerate the development of what really amounts to a new old energy source. The sustainability safeguards written into the regulations, combined with existing laws, will do a good job of protecting the multiple values we seek from the forest. Thank you.
Thanks. All right. So next we have Terry Estes. I have like a 1 minute thing just to hold. I might hold this up just in case.
I'll be very fast.
All right.
I'm Terry Estes from the Buckland Board of Health in Buckland, Mass., which is part of the Mohawk Trail Forest Program and also has the high school located there. We were nudged into this discussion several years ago by our local high school being approached by the Sapphire Program people to put in a new wood heating system in the high school.
Could you speak up a little?
We can.
Yeah, we can.
Okay.
Is there a microphone?
I don't know if that microphone's on.
Let's see. Is this on? Hello?
Anyway,
the Mohawk Trail High School several years ago was going to put in a wood heating system that was very efficient. It was an Aquafin system from Main Energy Systems. We didn't doubt that. But they had a high-efficiency propane system running at 96% that was brand new. And it made no sense to do this, so it pushed the Board of Health into looking into the wood heating systems and what the Sapphire program was trying to do. And we opposed that based on public health issues, that there were no air quality studies done on these heating systems, that in fact there would probably be no air studies done on them at all, that this is million BTU heating system, which is under the cutoff for having any regulation. So anyway, we got involved in this issue that way, and it brought us forward to this point of being in opposition to any inclusion of biomass in this regulation, which is encouraging more wood heat when we already have problems in Franklin County has the highest asthma rate, and the third member of our Board of Health is a medical doctor who deals with some of these issues, and he stood up at the very first meeting and said, so what air studies have you done on how this is going to affect the school population, which includes seventh graders, I guess. And they said, well, we've done no air studies, that we don't have that data, and Hopefin doesn't really have much data because they're made in Europe and Austria, and they don't have to test. They can test. So the Board of Health is opposed to regulation, including biomass.
Thank you. Next, we have Kent Parkley.
Good morning. My name is Kent Hartwig, Manager of Corporate Affairs for Renewable Energy Group. Thank you for the opportunity to comment today on this rulemaking and for including biodiesel as an eligible liquid fuel. Renewable Energy Group is North America's largest producer of advanced biofuel and operates 14 biorefineries in the United States and Europe. We also have a feedstock processing facility and research development capacities. Appreciate the time and effort the department has put into this proposed rulemaking, and Massachusetts should be applauded for its effort to bring lower carbon alternative energy sources into the marketplace. Given the time limitations, I'd like to highlight some of our more detailed written comments, which we have already provided. In the definition section, we have some specific suggestions. REG is concerned that the definition of APS ineligible energy sources as written inadvertently creates a potential loophole for biofuels created in an existing petroleum refinery, often referred to as co-processing. While co-processing does produce limited quantities of biofuels, their presence is intermingled with refined petroleum products, making detection and measurement very difficult and less expensive, and time-consuming testing is applied on a per-batch basis. because there's no practical way for the state to ensure that only eligible co-processed materials actually shipped and utilized in Massachusetts. We suggest the department add a section defining co-processed liquid biofuels and indicating them as ineligible. Related to the definition of eligible liquid biofuels, REG continues to support removing or replacing the word organic when describing biofuel feedstocks. Organic can be used to describe crop production methods that do not involve pesticides or herbicides, which should not be attributed to the biofuel production or the feedstocks we utilize. Additionally, REG supports adding used cooking oil, inedible corn oil, and oil co-products from crops grown for protein or animal feed to this definition. Section 16.5 eligibility criteria for APS alternative generation units. When discussing the cap on generation units using liquid biofuels, the language provides for a cap not to exceed 20% of the total annual compliance obligations for the compliance year. REG believes the number is artificially low. Constrains the APS, and we would suggest a cap at 50% on participation, but would also support other organizations which cap it at 40%. Speaking related to the section that talks about a quality assurance program, or QAP. A federal QAP program is designed to support the integrity of the RIN market and the renewable fuel standard. I'm trying to skip forward here. Under the APS proposal, actual real fuel, meaning ASTM standards, must be purchased and then burned in an approved equipment. At no time will RINs be an acceptable alternative to the actual consumption of liquid biofuels in improved equipment. A fraudulent RIN or a RIN that does not represent a set amount of biofuel can never be utilized for compliance, since actual fuel must be delivered and utilized. Given that RINs are not an APS compliance mechanism and only real fuel will be utilized, a QAP requirement is not necessary, and compliance will come in the form of verifiable actual gallons being burned in approved equipment. Thank you for the opportunity to present it.
All right, next we have Joe Radwich.
Which I'm a landowner in the Berkshires. I live in eastern Mass. I happen to be a timber harvester. I do produce some chips. I am a member of the Massachusetts Federal Americans Forest Association. Some of the products seem to be we're concerned about deforesting, cutting everything down to make chips. From a business side of it, there's not enough money involved. So I don't think we're going to have to worry about all the trees being cut. I didn't realize what we had here. I would have brought handouts. I have pictures of places where I've logged. My big concern should not be about the biomass, but it should be about encroachment from developments. That's going to be the real issue as far as losing our forest. I'm thinking that we should do something for Pine Tree, which is our only commercial chip plant that I happen to deal with, or my friends deal with. It is a large organization. There's a big pyramid of people, and I'm going to say there's people that are get an income. We shouldn't make rules to make sure everybody lives, but on the other hand, we should make rules to put people out of business. When you look at a load of chips going down the road, the chips themselves are worth pennies. I'm not going to clear cut my couple hundred acres in the Berkshires to get a few $1,000 worth of chips out of it. I mean, at one point I'd rather do good forestry work and have a better crop for my grandchildren. I have grandchildren, so I am concerned about the trees. I want them to have my trees. So there's got to be a balance here. In the 80s, there were programs for forestry work to reduce better timber. We all weed our gardens, don't we? I mean, I don't know how many people have gardens here, but we weed them. And that's what we want to do with the woods. But if we don't have a market, even a marginal market, to get rid of this stuff, what do we do? Essentially, Massachusetts, as we all know, or should know, was a field turn of the century, right? So there's all stone walls in the woods. If you go into the woods, forest grows back. I mean, I drove 80 miles today. I went by 64 miles and nothing but woods. So I think the concern about losing all of our woods to biomass is not a problem. 1 minute left. Oh, I like this.
Yeah.
We pull numbers, graded. So, you know, I have mixed emotion about the whole thing because I'm involved in all of it. I've logged long enough down my area. The encroachment for losing our woods are developments. Places that I've logged that were classified forests that I've logged multiple times are now subdivisions. Granted, they're nice million-dollar homes, but the trees are gone. So I think that concern, and we need to support the people. There's more woodcutters and out here that need to make a living. You know, if we're all retired and we don't have to make any more money, then, yeah, let's just stop everything. So that's what I have. We didn't have to open that door.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we have John Galt.
I'm from Pittsfield. I'm the treasurer of Berkshire Bike Path Council. I'll be well under 3 minutes. I just don't understand why we're giving extra tax money to... In other words, I thought clean energy was supposed to be something that didn't produce carbon dioxide. I think that's the basic problem that we're all facing with this climate change. And we're talking about just giving tax credits to a new way to produce carbon dioxide. I think that I welcome these fields of solar panels that I see going up. I think that's where we ought to be putting our tax credits.
Thanks. Yes.
Next we have Steve Kroll, or Noel.
Oh.
Noel. Yep, sorry. I couldn't see if it was an N or R.
Sorry, I didn't realize I was on that. I was just on the attendance list. I believe we do need to have a destination for the low-quality products. I own some land, a lot of low-quality wood that over time is going to have to get logged to maintain the quality of the habitat. But I also have concerns about air pollution. And we have a serious problem in the state with phase one OHHs. I'm actually relocating just to get away from one. It's great to have incentives, but we need to have a stick to go with the carrot to make sure that not only the new stuff is clean, we need to have testing to ensure that it's clean at the stack, not a mile away because air doesn't disperse evenly. And we need to have a program to get rid of and penalize people that don't replace these horribly filthy, and I'm sorry, that's the only word to use. They're killing people. Early OHHs and even wood burning stoves. Just because wood grows back over time does not make it green or clean. You need to pay, natural gas is cleaner at the stack than a significant percentage of these pellet stoves and other things that are going into houses. Yes, big facilities put in fancy, expensive stuff to clean the output. But all this small stuff that we're incentivizing is not being monitored, and the average person doing it doesn't understand any of this stuff.
That's
right. So we need to pay attention to both. And if this state agency isn't the right one to put a stick, going to put incentives, we need to make sure that the other appropriate agencies that can put the stick in are doing it and are funded to do it, to do the monitoring. Just because you put in a regulation to say, we're going to check that, if there's no money to fund the people and the equipment to do the monitoring, it's worthless. But we also need to look at habitat. So it's both ends of this have to be paid attention to. Thank you.
Thank you. Next we have... George
Johns? Johns?
Yeah.
My name is George Jones. Yeah. I'm with the Seaman Paper Company. We're one of those bigger users with all the fancy stuff, so I'd like to talk a little bit about that. We operate a paper mill in Templeton, Massachusetts. Previously, we burned 1.8 million gallons of 1% sulfur number 6 oil to generate steam on our plant. There's no natural gas in our area. In 2006, we installed our first biomass boiler. In 2009, we installed a second boiler and a back pressure turbine. We burn approximately 31,000 tons of biomass. 50% is shredded wood pallets. 50% is green chips. 90% of those are landfill. We've been able to reduce our sulfur dioxide emissions, which is acid rain, by 99%. We've reduced our NOx by about 15%. That's smog. And biomass is considered greenhouse gas neutral. We also co-generate 1.8 million kilowatt hours of electricity. We produce our steam at 280 psi, run it through a back pressure turbine, and use the exhaust generate electricity and then use the exhaust steam to dry our paper. So that's the most efficient way of using energy. And all of our wood ash is composted on our composting site in Westminster, Massachusetts. So we consider ourselves to be green. Anyways, what we would ask is that, and I'd also like to mention that when oil went up to $150 a barrel and we lost a lot of industries in New England who didn't have natural gas, biomass saved us. We probably wouldn't be here now if we hadn't had relief from that. We would just ask that you take into account for larger users some of the things that might not make sense. Covered storage, we have to have a chip pile with 500 tons of chips there. We do have a silo right at the plant where we have off-site storage for the chip pile. Also, cold starts don't apply. We have operators who actually handle that, so not an automatic, but perfectly people control starting on that. So thank you very much. We appreciate your attention to us.
Thanks, Roger. Next, we have Derek Phelps.
Good morning. My name is Derek Phelps. I'm Director of Market and Project Development for Fuel Cell Energy. Fuel Cell Energy, as I think you know, is a manufacturer of ultra-clean, high-efficiency fuel cell power systems with operations in neighboring Connecticut. We employ more than 500 people worldwide in the fields of research, development, manufacturing, installation, and servicing of clean energy technology. We currently operate more than 300 megawatts of power across three continents. I'm going to provide two very general comments and then two specific comments on the draft, and I emailed these in this morning. Stationary grid-scale fuel cell units offer a variety of resiliency benefits, including in the event of a grid outage, a fuel cell will disconnect from the grid and maintain itself ready to reconnect and resume grid-connected operations, and a fuel cell unit is able to independently or in concert with other distributed energy systems and resources form an essential off-grid island in either seamless or drop-and-pick-up transition schemes for an off-grid island to support resiliency. Relative to societal benefits, stationary grid-scale fuel cell units provide a variety of societal benefits, including ultra-clean, the fact that they are ultra-clean resources due to their virtual absence of pollutants, which supports sustainability goals and facilitates clean air permitting during installation. They are reliable baseload units that provide continuous electricity and heat around the clock, and often generate significant tax revenue for the host municipalities. With respect to specific comments on the draft, in lieu of the additional 60% overall efficiency standard proposed in the draft, FCE supports the recommendation that the DOER use the defined emission standard and eliminate the proposed efficiency standard. FCE supports this recommendation given that the proposed standard calls for different provisions for fuel cell technology in contrast to other technologies, and that raises the potential it may otherwise detract from a focus on the more critical standard of emissions. And finally, as suggested by the National Fuel Cell Research Center, with whom we work closely, FCE recommends that the DOER use metrics such as capacity factor, the reduction and elimination of greenhouse gases, and criteria air pollutants to more appropriately map the contributions of fuel cell systems to the APS goals. So Fuel Cell Energy appreciates the opportunity to comment on the DOER drafts. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Next we have Michelle Morantz.
My name is Michelle Morantz. I'm from Longmeadow, Massachusetts. Thank you for holding this this hearing in Western Massachusetts. I'm going to skip over my several paragraphs about the importance of retaining forests in our state because they function as carbon sinks to fight the disintegration of our environment and to fight climate change. What I'll focus on instead, due to the time limit, are two other points that I wanted to make. The impact of a subsidy, which would spur the growth of clear cutting and logging in our state on economics, and the economics that we're facing, and also on health issues. With respect to economics, I'm going to begin by asking this question. Why should we, as Massachusetts taxpayers, subsidize deforestation and increased air pollution, particularly since a recent poll revealed that over 70% of Massachusetts residents want their energy to come from renewable resources? If the majority of Massachusetts residents want clean energy, shouldn't the Department of Energy Resources subsidize the clean tech companies that are springing up all over the state, especially in Western Massachusetts? On another economic note, Western Mass has a well-established tourist industry that annually draws millions of visitors to this part of the state. Have you considered the negative impact that logging expansion will have on our state forests, the beauty of our rural areas, and our roads? As a last economic point, please note what happened to the wood-burning industry in Maine. For the last 20 years, power plants in Maine received $2.6 billion in ratepayer subsidies. Despite that influx of taxpayer money, the plants shut down anyway. When the legislature voted additional subsidies to prevent further shutdowns, over $20 million in higher electricity costs was predicted for ratepayers. Let's not have Massachusetts follow this example by subsidizing an economically inefficient means of providing energy. My final point addresses the negative health impact of any wood-burning facility, be it a power plant, school furnaces, or home stoves. A study by the World Health Organization concluded that wood fuel energy is, in fact, carcinogenic, that's the word they used, because of particulate and toxic gas emissions. Reinforcing these findings, a Harvard Health study released last May concluded that there is no safe amount of particulates when it comes to their impact on our health. The American Lung Association has also written that though everyone is at risk from particle pollution, the youth, elderly, and those with pre-existing respiratory diseases like asthma are at greater risk. Let's talk about what this means for us in Massachusetts and in Springfield, the Springfield area, on a local level. Did you notice that the Centers for Disease Control have identified Massachusetts, I'm almost done, as having a higher asthma rate than the national average, and Springfield children in particular suffered twice the national rate of asthma? Let me just say my last paragraph, because I know someone from the American Lung Association is here. In closing, I'd like to reiterate that there is no ecological, economic, or health benefit that justifies the citizens of Massachusetts subsidizing the wood fuel industry. With the clean energy options available to consumers today, please do not insult our intelligence by trying to impose on us a pollution-producing and health-destroying technology masquerading as a clean energy solution.
Next, we have Laura Marks.
Are you collecting this? My name is Laura Marks, and I'm a forest ecologist with the Nature Conservancy Massachusetts chapter. I'm going to paraphrase some of our written comments that were submitted to DOER. The Nature Conservancy is an international nonprofit conservation organization working around the world to protect ecologically important lands and waters for nature and people. The Conservancy and its members have protected over 24,000 acres of habitat in Massachusetts, and we provide input based on best available science to help landowners, communities, agencies, and nonprofits conserve and manage forests in a way that maximizes the clean water and air, forest products, wildlife habitat, recreation, and economic benefits of forests. We applaud the DOER for revising the definition of eligible wood fuel to remove wood from land clearing as an eligible source of fuel. As the Conservancy and many other organizations and stakeholders, including Mass Audubon, Mass Forest Alliance, PFBI, and New England Forestry Foundation have commented in the past, wood harvested during conversion of forest to developed land is by definition not sustainable. By making this change, DOER has avoided setting up a policy inconsistent with the rest of the department's efforts to reduce emissions and further ensured that wood heat systems that receive alternative energy credits are reducing greenhouse gas emissions compared to fossil fuel systems. Thank you for making that change. Climate change is the biggest threat to Massachusetts forests, wildlife, and arguably communities. So we need all the tools in the toolbox to fight climate change. This includes forest reserves that perpetually sequester and store carbon, as well as sustainably managed forests that produce wood for buildings, paper, furniture, and fuel. Climate change is also increasing levels of ozone and other air pollutants, and against this changing backdrop, DOER will need to continually evaluate whether the particulate emissions limits set for wood heat facilities in the guideline on biomass, biogas, and biofuels are sufficient to protect public health. Expanding the eligible renewable thermal technologies in the Alternative Energy Portfolio Standard to include wood heat and other types of renewable thermal energy will help the Commonwealth meet its emissions reductions goals, and scaling up help leading states meet the goals of the Paris Agreement. Thank you.
Okay. All right, next we have Michael Ann Bosey.
For agreeing to have a hearing in Western Mass. As you can see, there's a lot of concerned residents on both sides of the issue that appreciate the chance to testify. I'm the director of Arise for Social Justice, which is a low-income rights organization based in Springfield, and we address housing, homelessness, and public health. I've lived in my home city of Springfield for six of the last 7 decades, and I've spent a lot of the last decade opposing the construction of a biomass plant in Springfield. One of the things I've learned in the last decade is to understand the links between public health, climate change, and the burning of fossil fuels for energy, whether it's heat or electricity. Now, I understand the regulations under consideration are not directly relevant to the construction and operation of biomass incinerators that produce that burn wood for electricity. But I do believe that these regulations are a foot in the door for the biomass industry, which in Springfield, Greenfield, and Russell has shown its willingness to cherry-pick science for the sake of profit. I do have a lot of sympathy for the individual woodlot owners it's a source of income for them. But it's a little like the last gap of the coal industry. Sorry, that's just the way it is. So you're going to hear a lot of good testimony. I only want to make a few points. First, the Commonwealth residents who will be most affected by the burning of wood are not the voices you'll be most likely to hear in comments on these regulations. But I want to tell you that the regular onslaught of pollution that our communities face is substantial, even if not at the top of the priority list for those struggling just to survive. You must take those voices into account. Second, the proposed regulations that would require chippers, pellet producers, other companies to provide fuel for biomass facilities, use sustainable forestry practices. But in Springfield, as elsewhere, the equipment used to log trees, convert them to wood pellets, and transport them on a continuing basis are part of the CO2 pollution and not calculated in their impact. Biomass is supposed to become carbon neutral in 20 years. Even if that projection were accurate, and many of us are skeptical, we do not have 20 years to mitigate the effects of climate change. In fact, we have no time at all, as pollution and the effects of climate change already impact our communities in myriad ways. Just ask the elderly person struggling without air conditioning or the families with children suffering from asthma what they would think about any increase in air pollution. Finally, if there's anything I've learned in the last 10 years, it's that burning anything to produce heat or electricity is a step in the wrong direction, will not meet the requirements of the Global Warming Solutions Act unless we eliminate sources of pollution, preserve our forests, and actively promote and fund alternative sources of energy which do not require combustion. I have no time for that. Thank you.
Next, we have Madeline Liebling.
Good morning. My name is Madeline Liebling. I live in Buckland, Massachusetts. I'm a citizen. I don't represent any group. Thank you for allowing me to speak. I live in a town that's a small town in a valley which has houses very close together, which has a lot of wood burning. People wood burning stove, and I'm a person with environmental sensitivities and an autoimmune illness, and I almost constantly cannot live in my home winter and now summer as well because people burn campfires in the town, and I smell wood smoke constantly, almost constantly in my home because I'm sensitive. I smell it in a way that other people smell it. I'll say, can you smell the wood, you know, the wood or the fumes, and people will say, no, I can't, but I can smell it. So I'm aware it's always there. And I have practically no recourse to get away from that. I know it affects my health. I can feel it. I can sit in my own home, and my throat starts to hurt from the smoke I'm smelling in my home. So, and I know that, you know, I really, hats off to the Board of Health in my town, we're really trying to tackle this problem, but there are no really effective enforcement mechanisms for any of this. I mean, I'm talking about the personal people burning stoves. You know, I don't know a lot about the biomass, the larger systems, but I can say that, as someone said earlier, the enforcement is a really difficult problem. Like, how are these things going to be enforced? There are really no mechanisms for this at all, and measuring the pollution and so on. So I'd just like to say, you know, as a person who lives with the effect of this on my health, I appreciate that you would take this into consideration. And I don't feel that burning, as the person before me said, burning anything, and no matter what's said about it, can be clean. It seems like it's very difficult, if not impossible, to make it clean. So thank you.
Next, we have Steve Ryth.
Is there a mic here?
It's not working.
There's not a mic. Okay, we'll try to speak up. Steve Ryth is my name. I'm from Heath, Massachusetts, one of the old towns in the area here. I want to consider quickly the goals of the alternative energy portfolio standard and ask the question, does the burning of biomass really contribute to realizing those goals? That's the basic strategy here. This seems to be the first goal of the standard. After all, we do have fossil fuels now. The first goal of the standard is to reduce CO2 emissions into the atmosphere. The premise is CO2 goes into the atmosphere, it traps heat as a result of interaction with water vapor, and the temperature of the planet goes up. So the question is, does burning biomass really diminish the amount of CO2 that goes into the atmosphere? The answer is clearly no. I mean, they're all hydrocarbons. And whether you're talking about fossil fuel or whether you're talking about living trees and plants that you cut down, they're all hydrocarbons. There's no way of combusting hydrocarbons without contributing CO2 into the atmosphere, and significant amounts of CO2 into the atmosphere. The only difference between biomass, cutting down living trees, and fossil fuels is that biomass contributes more CO2 into the atmosphere, about 2.43 times the amount that natural gas will contribute to it. If you take the equivalent of tonnage, the equivalent amounts of wood pellets and natural gas, you're going to get a huge amount more CO2 pouring into the atmosphere than you get from natural gas. So why doesn't make any sense to me? This doesn't really realize the goals of the portfolio standard. The second goal of the portfolio standard is to reduce air pollution. Again, you've got to ask yourself, are you really reducing air pollution with these particular strategy, with burning of biomass? If you actually look at the amount of, I have charts here, if you look at the amount of particulate matter, whether also noxious, the noxious toxic gases that get emitted, I'm thinking of the nitrous oxide, sulfur oxides of particulate matter, it's absurd. I mean, you're getting more by burning biomass, living trees that we've cut down, than you are with fossil fuels. So again, are you really realizing the goal, the strategy of this alternative portfolio? It seems to me you're really not. It doesn't make any sense to me. Look, if we live in cities, we live in Springfield. I live up near Shelburne Falls. When you're burning biomass, when you're burning pellets in low and high density areas in cities and towns, you're contributing to the ill health of people. Imagine smelling a wood burn. We just now had someone here smelling a wood burning stove from a neighbor. You want to put these facilities in schools and have children exposed to the pollutant effects of this. There's absolutely no advantage of burning biomass over fossil fuel. So why even have the portfolio standard in the first place? It makes no sense to me. Lastly, I just want to talk about environmental degradation. No doubt, burning fossil fuels are degrading to the environment. Extracting oil from the environment is very degrading. What about the forest deforestation, or the potential for deforestation that you have with this? You know, back 200 years ago, if you came to this area, you'd see no trees. I know we have to at the end. You'd see no trees. Why? Because the area, the land was used for cultivating for farmland. It was also used for wood burning. So my question is to you, why would we want to degrade the environment, the beautiful forest land we have here, in the service of generating energy? Just makes no sense to me. There's a cost in doing this. The cost of subsidizing this is to take money away from developing the technology that really could replace fossil fuels. So there's an opportunity cost here, and I suggest, therefore, we don't incur it. We don't adopt this strategy and consider doing the research and development we need to replace fossil fuels. Thank you.
Next, we have David Galt.
David Galt, 27 Lakeview in Peru. It's going to be very brief because other people have said things much more articulately than I could possibly ever get to. But I do not agree with incentivizing burning wood. Basically, particulate matter, you're going to wind up killing people. So you are going to incentivize the wrong thing. It just should be taken off the books. Thank you.
Michael Bartlett.
morning. Thank you. Mike Bartlett, Massachusetts licensed forester number 12. I work for Hull Forest Products, the sister company Hull Forest Lands. Hull Forest Lands owns approximately 8,000 acres in Massachusetts, with the vast majority of that having been protected from development and with permanent conservation easements. I support your proposed changes for the regulations here. The need for markets for low-grade materials are essential to the practice of good forestry and keeping our forests healthy. They're a byproduct of what we do. The idea that people would cut the forest for providing chips for burning is absurd. It just does not economically feasible. But some incentives to improve those markets would certainly enhance our abilities to provide forest landowners with a better practice of better quality of forest management and to grow bigger and better trees that can be put into products that do store carbon for long periods of time. As one of the speakers said earlier, one of the people, you know, weeding our forests. A forest is either clear cut or blown down by a hurricane or tornado. It will regenerate itself. We're very fortunate in this part of the country. We stop mowing our lawn for part of a year, we're going to be growing trees. You start out with a young forest with 10 to 20,000 trees per acre. 100 years later, if it hasn't been thinned, you're down to 200 to 300 trees per acre. Mother Nature will thin the forest itself. If we can enhance Mother Nature's abilities in producing a forest and get some societal benefits by using that material that is going to die anyways, or is dead, having some markets for those are very important to do what we need as far as practicing good forestry. There's many species of wildlife. Those populations are declining because we don't have much young forest these days. There are incentives to provide people with to create young forests by having better markets for these materials is certainly going to enhance our abilities to do those types of projects and provide them at a lower cost down the road to, you know, to that individual that owns the property. So that being said, I would support, you know, Vermont. Almost 50% of the schools are using biomass heating facilities. I'm sure the people in Vermont are concerned about their children's health and well-being as well. But it's being done there. It's keeping local dollars in the local economy and keeping their forests healthier. If climate change, we have greater stresses on our forests, such as droughts and insects. Having some markets to be able to remove this material and use it is certainly another option for us, as to meet our energy needs. Mary Hull, one of the owners of the company, has submitted written testimony, and I thank you for your time to make comment today.
Next we have James Van Valkenburg.
Involved with a company called Froehling Energy. We are a company based in Peterborough, New Hampshire, that has installed about 180 wood pellet and dry wood chip boilers throughout New Hampshire and Vermont, mostly in schools, a lot in residential, but we actually shifted a few years ago more into the school and commercial sites. We now have, if we added up all our customers and what we're offsetting, it's about 1 million gallons of fuel oil that's no longer being burned in these regions. And it's also using very local fuel. It's a very stable price fuel. And it comes from the local forest. If you spend $1,000 on oil, you end up maybe 95% of that goes out of the region, out of the country perhaps. If you spend $1,000 on biomass, on the dry wood chips or pellets, about a tremendous amount, like 85% stays within the region. Mostly it has to do with the use of gas and so forth for transportation. We, over these years, we've also created, 3 years ago, a plant that makes precision dry wood chips, which is a third biomass fuel. Green wood chips, or you take a tree and chip it, put it in the boiler, basically. The boiler dries it out on site. You take wood pellets, they're down to, you know, instead of 50% moisture, pellets are about 7% moisture. Those are very efficient, very cost-effective generally, and they're very efficient to burn. The PDCs are 25% moisture, and they're chipped down so they can be transported easily and blown into holding storage bins and so forth. And we find they're 35% less costly than what the pellets are at this point. And you take a little less infrastructure cost. Cost is really involved here in the transition in most situations where you're offsetting oil, which is more expensive, and you're looking for a cheaper fuel, but an efficient fuel. Our company is founded on the use of the very most efficient technology that's out there right now, which mostly comes from Austria. These are all tested by NYSERDA in New York. They're very demanding, and all of our equipment complies with that, and that's exactly what your program is doing as well. You're requiring that all this equipment be tested. And there's a report that was done by BTEC, which is the Biomass Energy Resource Center, I want to point to, because it's very interesting. It shows that a typical residential size system would produce particle pollution, particulate matter, PM is what it's called in gross. And if I just look at the various ways you can heat your house, a wood stove is 281 pounds per year of particle. A modern wood stove that's EPA approved is 85 pounds per year into the atmosphere. This is particulate. This is what people mostly are concerned about, it seems. A modern pellet stove is about 30 pounds per year. So you see we're declining nicely. But a modern pellet boiler, such as all of these that are approved, are about 2 pounds per year. 2 pounds per year. If you worry about Worcester County as having a very high pollution of particulate matter, that's wood stoves. And the further west you go, those are wood stoves that are contributing this. I can put in a pellet boiler in a school burn that's now burning 30,000 gallons of oil, and I can bring that particulate matter down to what's more like a pellet stove in a single house or something in that order. If the scale, you can see, is quite massive. High efficiency, high filtration, or I should say suppression of the particulate matter, which we invest a lot of money in, the European organizations have. So I encourage you to look at that technology and consider that technology as a positive. It's not a negative, and all the things having to do with the forests being sustainably harvested and economically viable are very important. We just want to support that. Thank you.
Patrick Devlin.
Good morning. Thank you for this opportunity to speak. My name is Patrick Devlin. I live in Greenfield. I got involved in town government as a result of the biomass issues in Greenfield. I served on the Greenfield Town Council for 6 years. I served as chair of the Economic Development Committee. And I'm proud to say that I chaired a committee which developed an ordinance prohibiting large-scale biomass incineration in Greenfield. A copy of this ordinance is attached. A group of concerned citizens and scientists worked with our committee to craft this legislation, which was spurred by a townwide vote to prevent a biomass burning plant to be constructed in our town. Our work was informed by scientific evidence and testimony based on the state-mandated committee called the Manomet Study. To date, we have no scientific data which contravenes that study. I wonder what new scientific evidence you have which makes this study outdated. I probably don't need to remind you that there are ample scientific and medical proof that burning in any form adds to the increase in health-related and respiratory problems among our citizens, most notably lung cancer and childhood asthma. This assertion is amply supported by the American Lung Association and the American Medical Association. We cannot take a step backwards now and allow burning to harm our citizenry. The science behind the Manomet study was unflawed, and I do not understand why you consider burning in any form to be safe, except perhaps because you are being strongly pressured again by individuals or companies who would profit from it. It doesn't matter if you're burning for electricity or thermal applications. Honestly, folks, This is not the way Massachusetts wants to go as they strive to meet their emission standards. This will increase emissions, not reduce them. Thank you.
Yep.
Tom Nielsen.
Stand here. Well, to continue with the Patrick, but I'm Tom Nielsen. I'm from Greenfield. As a public health, retired public health worker, I work with people with compromised immune systems. Incineration is not a good thing. Hydrocarbons have been mentioned. Particulate matter is causal to, it encourages cardiopulmonary disease. Cancer has been mentioned. I speak as a retired teacher in Greenfield, where one in five children has asthma, and the school nurse says a lot of these cases are not even diagnosed. I speak as a retired coach, and athletes are adversely affected because of the exertion in inhaling this particulate matter. And I speak as a resident of this planet and flanked by younger people. It is not sensational to say we are in the sixth extinction.
Yes.
Yeah.
Not at all. And we have to accept responsibility for taking care of this planet however we can, and we need to save these trees. And there are, I do not support these rights and using incineration.
I'm giving them money.
Robert Morton.
My name is Robert Morton. I'm here to represent Newport Biodiesel. We're the only biodiesel producer in Rhode Island and one of several small producers in the New England region. We've been in existence for about 10 years, and we currently produce about 5 million gallons of ASTM certified biodiesel each year. Our feedstock is exclusively used cooking oil, and we collect from more than 3,200 restaurants throughout New England. We are fully in support of 225 CMR 16, and when the rules have been finalized, we will certainly apply to seek qualification as an eligible liquid biofuel supplier. For many years, the heating oil industry in New England has been on tenuous ground of bioheat, particularly with higher blends of biodiesel, creates a much cleaner fuel that can compete with fossil fuels and provides a way forward for the future. This program will encourage heating oil distributors to utilize biodiesel, thereby creating a cleaner fuel with significantly less greenhouse gas emissions. We fully support the definition for eligible liquid biofuel, which states the liquid fuel must be derived from organic waste stocks. Used cooking oil typically reduces greenhouse gases by 86% compared to petroleum. Furthermore, this provision helps the program to support regional biodiesel producers, since all New England biodiesel producers generate using used cooking oil. It also helps to eliminate imported soybean-based biodiesel from Argentina that is currently undercutting domestic production. We support the minimum 10% blends of biodiesel and hope that as the program goes forward, higher blends will occur. We suggest that DOER eliminate the requirement for a quality assurance plan issued by EPA. Many producers, both large and small, don't have that program for various reasons. By simply stating that in order to qualify as an eligible liquid biofuel supplier, a producer must be registered in EPA's Renewable Fuel Standard Program and must verify that they produce biodiesel from organic waste should be sufficient to meet this requirement. Also, the cap on available number of attributes for generation units seems very restrictive at the specified 20% level. An independent review of alternative energy credit market by Kevin Bedford indicates that a 40% cap of biofuel would not affect the AICS market negatively and would provide an opportunity for expansion of the biodiesel market while still providing CHP market a sufficient AICS allocation. Finally, we do not believe it is necessary to limit the number of AICS sold on a quarterly basis. The other eggs currently in the market don't have such a restriction, and limiting the number of eggs sold per quarter could mean that distributors and aggregators might have to wait for additional quarters before being able to sell their eggs. We favor a free and open market for eggs and encourages participation in the program. Thanks for the opportunity to submit comments on the program. We look forward to participating in the future.
Joe Radwick.
I must have signed the list twice.
Oh, okay.
So I would like to ask how many people were opposed to the gas line coming through.
I don't know. We're not commenting on it.
The Henry Morgan gas
line? Yeah, let's not talk about
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
It's different hearing.
Susan Mucino.
Good morning. My name is Susan Mucino. I'm from Pittsfield. My family, my parents, my grandparents, my husband's family, all from Massachusetts. So we have many friends and extended family in the state, own two properties in the state. I'm currently the Vernon Russo Professor of Applied Science at Trinity College in Hartford. And I'm a neuroscientist by training and an environmentalist at heart. My professional life as a research scientist is focused on understanding brain diseases, preventing and treating brain disease, and promoting and supporting brain health. I'm the senior editor on three major volumes focused on brain homeostasis and health. It's now crystal clear that our lifestyles and environment matter enormously to everyone's brain health and matter the most to children, older people, and those with any pre-existing vulnerability. My professional advocacy for brain health works alongside my advocacy for a healthy environment, and this includes healthy forests and the best forms of renewable energy. Massachusetts is a leader in many ways and really has the chance to do so again. I applaud and fully support the APS regulations for solar thermal, heat pumps, and geothermal energy. These energy sources provide local jobs and clean, stable, on-site energy. Geothermal also offers reliable cooling. These are established and long-lasting technologies, yet they remain underutilized and should be a real focus of the portfolio. They're manufactured in the United States. They provide local jobs. They're quiet. They do not pollute. They do not kill wildlife or take up farmland or habitats. In short, they lack the negative impacts of other forms of renewable energy. And I hope that Massachusetts will promote these technologies very aggressively and really be a leader in this because they're underutilized. I don't support burning wood, and I'm surprised that burning woody biomass would be considered part of Massachusetts' progressive portfolio. It's simply not clean energy. The health impacts are already clear and continue to mount. It's now been confirmed that the small particulates go directly into the brain, and particulate pollution of the size created by wood burning has been linked to poor cognitive function and acceleration of brain aging and Alzheimer's disease, and this is just the tip of the iceberg because new research shows that these effects act synergistically with other common stressors and vulnerabilities like immune function problems and metabolic syndrome, which is a general term for a constellation of syndromes including diabetes, obesity, insulin resistance, and cardiovascular risk factors. As you may be aware, Alzheimer's is poised to bankrupt healthcare, and we have no effective treatments. It was finally acknowledged in a major way at the Alzheimer's Association International Conference in July 2017 that prevention is currently our best and by far our most cost-effective strategy in combating this epidemic. I understand that some of the most compelling recent papers on brain health impacts were not published when these standards were written. Neuroscience is slowly but surely gaining a lot of momentum and focusing more on brain health, and I attend several major conferences every year. There's a lot of additional evidence coming down the pipeline. Now, even if my main advocacy and goal beyond this meeting is that brain health should be a cornerstone of public policy at all agencies and at all levels. But even if you're not worried about your brain or your risk of Alzheimer's disease, changes due to these inhaled particles happen at the cellular level by changing the level of methylation, expression of specific genes that are linked to cytokine and immune responses, cellular motility, angiogenesis, inflammation, wound healing, cell growth, differentiation, and development. And the genes that are altered are known to participate in dominant cancer-related signaling pathways. On the flip side, forests provide real documental benefits for brain health. one of the best things you can do is be outside.
Sorry, Susan, just about a minute over, so just if you could wrap up.
Oh, thank you. I'll wrap up. Regularly. It improves immune function, mental health, and living near a forest increases longevity, helps veterans with PTSD. A journalist wrote a very comprehensive book recently called The Nature Fix, which is very well referenced and outlines a lot of economic benefits for our forests and health benefits for our forests. So I'd really encourage everyone to read it. It could help to broaden our vision of what we can do with our forests instead of cutting them and burning them down. So as my final note, I just would like to say is that just because our forests are there doesn't mean maybe we should burn them. A farmer that lives near us has an extremely successful composting operation where he takes in woody biomass and other forest waste. He has a huge composting operation. People buy the soil. It's a big partnership between the town and the farmer. And just because I often hear environmentalists say, we must do something. This is irrational thinking. We should take a lesson from medicine and first do no harm.
Susan, sorry.
Focus on doing the right thing as effectively as possible. Yeah.
Janet Sinclair.
Thank you for having this hearing today. In case people didn't know, we actually had asked for this hearing. The hearing was ordered in Boston. Thank you, everybody, for coming. We had to write to our caller, our lawmakers. We had to write letters. We had to actually lobby to have a hearing in this part of the state where this affects us more than anywhere else. So thank you. I know that other people are going to speak better than I can on some of these issues. So I'd like to just say that I'd like to talk a little about something that people may not be aware of, which is that Massachusetts Forest Alliance, who is a trade group, got $250,000 from the U.S. Forest Service to promote wood burning in our state. Yep. They have another $144,000, which makes me here to tell you where that comes from. So it's a total of close to $400,000 that Mass Forest Alliance has to lobby our government to... one person here is a member of Mass Forest Alliance to be actually hired by DOER to sit here and help make decisions about these policies. Another thing I'd like to say is that what Susan was saying is that this is burning biomass is this perennial solution to forestry problems. It's like we have all these bad trees out there. What are we going to do with them? Burn them. I mean, honestly, I feel like Mass Forest Alliance and its cohorts are tremendously lacking imagination. These are not health experts. They're not climate experts. They're not anything. They're just trying to make the money and at our expense. The third thing I'd like to say is, as a community organizer, one of the things that happened in Greenfield, sorry to hear this, one of the things that happened in Greenfield is that people's lives got turned upside down to fight that project at Greenfield. And we were right. We were right in Russell, we were right in Greenfield, we were right in Springfield, and here we are fighting our government. We had to raise tens of thousands of dollars in Greenfield, a poor community, to fight off a bad idea. Turned out, we knew it was a bad idea, it's been proven it's a bad idea, and now we have another bad idea. And we had to fight off the Sapphire program, giving money to our school at Mohawk. It's like, really? You're going to burn wood in our school? Thank God for my Board of Health. That came to bat for us, and we pressured our school to be the first school in the state to say no to the Sapphire program, putting wood pellets in our school. Yeah. I'm sorry, I feel like crying. This is really hard for me. This is a very personal issue. So I have had to turn my life around, because of my health issues, because of my wood burning in my neighborhood, that stimulated me. And made me do this work on behalf of other people. Fortunately, my Board of Health is now helping me. But previously it didn't. So what happens is these communities get turned upside down, fighting off bad policy. We're fighting with our own government. DOER, who are you working for?
Thanks for having this hearing.
I'm Michael Kellett. Our organization, Restore the North Woods, has offices in Maine and Massachusetts. We have signed off on a more detailed letter, so I'm just going to try to keep it short and give you some of the major points. I've been working on New England forest issues for about 30 years, and much of it has been in Maine. And based on my Maine experience, I'm here today to register Restore's strong opposition to the revised draft regulations proposed by DOER to allow burning wood for heat to be eligible for clean energy credits through the state's alternative energy portfolio standard. We believe this misguided policy would increase the immediate release of carbon into the atmosphere, which would worsen climate change. It would increase toxic air pollution, which would harm public health. It would undermine the capacity of the forests to store carbon. And it's supposed to come from sustainable forestry, which is the favorite buzzword that we hear all the time about forestry. But the reality is there is no scientifically accepted definition of sustainable forestry. It's never been scientifically verified, or in fact, the DCR says it's an evolving definition. So there is no sustainable forestry standard. So, and in fact, these revised regulations are even looser than the earlier ones in giving a lip service to what sustainable forestry is. So there's no, all it has to do is be signed off by a forester, and it says sustainable, no matter how bad the job is or whatever. Massachusetts needs to learn from Maine. We need to learn a lesson as to what Maine did. It was mentioned earlier, I worked for more than two decades on trying to create a national park in northern Maine, and it became the Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument that President Obama designated in 2016. We were thrilled about that. That is already bringing in jobs and money to the region. In the meantime, the forest industry was getting subsidies from the state to log more and burn biomass and support biomass plants. It's been a total failure. So Massachusetts shouldn't make the same mistake. We should reject this idea. Instead of cutting and burning trees, our policy should be to protect our forests for the ecological, climate, recreational, public health, and economic benefits. This is the priority of the new National Monument of Maine, and it is working very well for Mainers. So we call on Governor Baker to place an immediate moratorium on the state incentives for logging and burning trees for energy. We also call on the legislature to amend our laws to eliminate this destructive and short-sighted policy. This would benefit the forest, the climate, and the health of the people of Massachusetts.
Yes. Thank you.
My name is Mary Booth. I am the director of the Partnership for Policy Integrity. I'm an ecosystem ecologist. I work on climate, and I've been working on biomass energy issues starting here in Massachusetts since 2008. Thank you for having this meeting. We're submitting very detailed comments to the state, 33 pages to be exact, on these regulations and the deficiencies that we've identified. Those comments were co-signed by a number of groups, some of whom are in this room. The ones that are not in this room are the American Lung Association, Center for Biological Diversity, Clean Air, Clean Water Action, Environment Massachusetts, Environmental League of Massachusetts, Greater Boston Physicians for Social Responsibility, Massachusetts Sierra Club, and the Toxics Action Center co-signed our comments. NRDC will also be sending their own comments individually that are substantially similar to ours. Every day we hear new information about how fast the climate is changing. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change tells us that to avoid literally dangerous climate change, we must reduce emissions immediately in the next couple of years and then work to achieve negative emissions, meaning we need to take CO2 out of the atmosphere. In other words, we need to be planting trees, not burning them.
That's right.
In these regulations, DOER has actually increased the amount of time over which biomass energy can show a benefit relative to fossil fuels by 50%.
Now, Michael Ann, I know you said it was 20 years, but they've actually made it 30. Biomass regulations enacted in 2012 stated bioenergy should show a benefit in 20 years. These proposed regulations lengthen that time to 30 years. Further, DOER has simply eliminated the part of the former biomass regulations that assessed life cycle emissions from biomass manufacturing, which, as I'm sure a number of you in this room know, can be considerable when you're making pellets. DOER is in essence saying it's fine with them that biomass energy increases biomass greenhouse gas emissions for decades. The Massachusetts Superior Court said last year that Massachusetts Global Warming Solutions Act requires that the state set limits for greenhouse gas emissions that decline each year. We believe DOER's regulations violate the spirit, if not the letter, of that decision. If DOER doesn't think biomass can show a greenhouse gas benefit in a reasonable amount of time, and reasonable here is arguably instantaneously, given the urgency of the climate crisis, then the answer is not to move the goalposts. Yes. The answer is to eliminate biomass from the list of subsidized technologies.
Right. Yes.
The regulations will also increase emissions of particulate matter. We recently analyzed EPA data and showed that Massachusetts has more pollution from residential wood burning than any other New England state. Fewer than 5% of homes in Massachusetts are emitting 80% of the particulate matter in the heating sector. This pollution accounts for about a quarter of particulate matter emissions from all sectors. Subsidizing biomass energy to the tune of millions of dollars will add to that pollution. Yet with these regulations, DOER did not even see fit to ensure that boilers meet the more protective EPA standards that are coming into force in 2 years. In other words, DOER will be subsidizing boilers that will not be legal under EPA standards. In our written comments on the regulations, we also note that DOER has eliminated specific forest protections that were previously required for biomass harvesting in Massachusetts. This is out of compliance with the enabling legislation. You were also supposed to have a public comment period to discuss sustainable forest standards, and that has not occurred. Massachusetts and citizens all over the country have had our fill of policymakers misleading us on climate. We want real science-based action on climate, not just words. The best thing the Baker administration could do to signal it's serious about climate change is to double down on subsidies for zero-emissions technologies and eliminate subsidies for burning trees for energy. You should immediately get to work protecting forests and increasing forest carbon sequestration. That will signal leadership to the entire country.
Yep.
Dave Cotton.
Good morning. It's going to be impromptu. I just saw at the Boston Globe this morning that they were having this meeting, and I own Cotton Tree Service in Northampton, and we've had a long-term connection with using biomass for power, and everybody in the room has facts that are of concern, and we all worry about our future and our families. One of the key elements I think that we're missing on that we all use power. We need 25,000 megawatts of power in New England, and by 2020 they tell me that we're going to lose 25% of generating capacity from shutting down generating plants that have outlived their time or we don't find to be environmentally responsible. The issue of having the biomass plants available is crucial. The healthy forest, as the doctor said, and the lady from Long Meadow, it's key to having an avenue so that we can manage the forest and put effort into maintaining the integrity and health of the forest. And we really are challenged. I've been in the harvest industry 45 years, and my family's been in the business for over 60 years. And climate change is a real negative factor. We're seeing tremendous stresses on trees. We're currently doing a project for the city of Northampton where the reservoirs, there's 200 acres of red pine plantation around the reservoirs, and a small microscopic insect called red pine scale is devastating the red pine. They're all dying. And the understory, we could let the trees die and fall, but when these 100-foot massive trees come down, they would crush the understory and destroy the successional trees. So we're working with the city, going in with climbing and technical removal techniques to protect the sugar, predominantly sugar maple, that are 40 to 60 years old. And by saving these young trees, they sequester carbon at four times the rate of older trees, and the red pines haven't really grown in the last 30 years because of density and age. So by having a viable market for the biomass, we are able to put that economic value into saving acres and acres and acres of these beneficial sugar maples, which will help with the issue with climate change. And it's, we don't want to burn our forests. That definitely would be counterproductive. And that's not the way it works. The way it works is when we harvest these red pines that are dying or dead, the anything that's valuable as lumber goes into a manufactured product which sequesters the carbon for whatever the purpose is. If it's put into one of your homes, it could be 200 years that carbon's removed from the atmosphere. When we get up to the unusable portions, they can be used for mulch. They can be left in the woods for some of the benefit of decomposition on the forest floor. But as they decompose, the carbon is still released in the atmosphere. The material that would be burned in these biomass plants are only the very top crown of the tree, which hasn't been in our atmosphere for more than 20 or 30 years, so it's new carbon. So the effects of the biomass plants, as a rule, the carbon that's ejected from the stacks is fairly new. And it's... when we burn fossil fuels, that carbon can be up to 2 million years old, and that really is a catalyst. One small factor I'd like to point out also, regionally, it's amazing how progressive we all are, and everybody has a commitment to it. The problem we have is that we get our products, all our clothes, and the abundance we have from somewhere, and unfortunately, China has taken over. We recently did a project for a gentleman that's an energy trader on Wall Street. And I inquired, I said, Mike, what does your firm do? And he said, well, we recently went to the Ukraine and we fixed the natural gas system because we were losing, they were losing 50% of the methane to atmosphere. So they got carbon, Toyota carbon credits. They sold to the Chinese for $5 billion. So they did $500 million worth of work. And they sold the carbon credits to the Chinese who produce all our belongings for $5 billion. The Chinese used, I said, what did they use the credits for? He said they built 550 cogeneration coal-fired plants with no emissions controls, and it complied because of the carbon credits. Well, in the mid-'80s, China did underground testing.
Just about you're about a minute and a half over, so just wrap it up.
I'll wrap it up.
Yep.
In the 80s, because this band of air we breathe is 10,000 feet thick and 24,000 miles around, in the 80s, China did underground nuclear testing. We had detectable levels fall in New England 7 days later. So with this massive expulsion of old carbon from China, we still suffer the facts. And so with the asthma issues in Greenfield that are escalating, there wasn't a wood-burning plant in place, so there's another underlying reason. And so globally, whatever we can do to take and try to minimize
it, gotta wrap
it
up.
Pretty important.
Really, yep.
Thank you.
Okay, yep. Ray Albrecht.
Good morning. My name is Ray Albrecht. I'm an environmental engineer. I'm from upstate New York, not from Massachusetts, but I'm with you folks. Just a bit of background. I'm here representing the National Biodiesel Board, but I also come to you as a retired staffer from the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority. I was a manager of their clean fuels program for 30 years. I retired about 8 years ago. I have stayed active. Renewable energy is something that you don't just step back from, okay? I'm going to, you know, keep working this until I'm, you know, until I'm gone, okay? So appreciate the opportunity to present. We commend Massachusetts for pushing forward with the thermal APS program. We've got a lot of things, a lot of conflict to resolve here. The National Biodiesel Board will be submitting comments on quality standards. Other speakers have already mentioned that, for example, waste feedstocks as a term needs to be hashed through. In a nutshell, I'm going to encourage you to go with the standards that have been established and really worked on hard by U.S. EPA and also the California Air Resources Board. So I would encourage you to really join forces with them as opposed to having your own local standard. So I'm going to address broader issues here. First of all, in terms of this program, there is a large component in the existing program for natural gas-fired systems, okay, CHP in particular. I'm going to make a recommendation that for the long term that you separate out real renewable thermal energy from anything that has something to do with natural gas, which is a fossil fuel, and we recognize the politics involved here, but as you move forward with this program, really have a program for renewable energy, not for other fossil fuels. In terms of the 20% cap on biodiesel within the existing program, yeah, we can, I think there is room for growth in that, although the real answer for the long term is increasing the percentage quota for the program in its entirety. I'm going to speak on the subject of solid biomass, not on behalf of NBB, but as a personal landowner. I am a member of the New York Forest Owners Association in New York State. I live in upstate New York. I have a 40-acre woodlot. I've managed it for 30 years now. I cut firewood, and I understand very personally and very keenly that active, sustainable forest management is the way for the future. Okay, I will, I will offer the argument that doing nothing with your forest is as environmentally harmful as clear cutting. You have to find that middle ground, which is complex. Okay, so I would encourage you to, to stick with this argument. One solution for you folks, okay, is to apply the same concept of energy credit multipliers, such as what you have used for solar PV and for geothermal heat pumps and so forth, to ultra-low emissions combustion systems, whether they're biodiesel or solid biomass fired, okay, open the door towards the very cleanest equipment getting higher levels of credits. And I think then you can address and resolve this broad cacophony of concerns that have been rightfully expressed. Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Glenn Ayers.
Thank you. My name is Glenn Ayers. I'm wearing my public health hat today, but I'm speaking as a private citizen. First off, I would say thanks for having this hearing here. It's nice that you would come out to Western Mass. And many people have said what I would say. I'm going to submit detailed comments before 5 p.m. But I just want to say, in general, I feel that these regulations are an embarrassment. We met a year ago in Amherst at UMass, made a lot of comments about how bad the regulations were. And my opinion is they're worse. They're worse this time. I think at this point, really the solution is a legislative solution to this problem, and that would be to remove the Clean Energy Fund from the fingers of DOER entirely. You've wasted millions of dollars on promoting biomass in the state. It's been a bad idea the whole time, but you can't stop for some reason. These regs are so discretionary that they refer to guidelines throughout. And if you pull out the guidelines are just meaningless. They are totally meaningless because you go to the last section, there's four guidelines. The last section is miscellaneous. The department may permit an exception from any provision of this guideline for good cause. That's guideline one. Guideline two. The department may permit an exception from any provision of this guideline for good cause. Guideline 3, the last section. The department, I don't even have to read it, I memorized it. The department may permit an exception from any provision of this guideline for good cause. What's good cause? Somebody gives you some money?
Yep.
Is that what it is?
Yep.
Somebody hires a lobbyist to sit in DOER, or you take somebody from DOER and put them in the dirty energy extension office at UMass, and that's good cause? Every bit of this is garbage, in my opinion. It's garbage. You need to set. I've been reading regulations since 1980. I've been in public health. Environmental regulation. These are terrible, terrible regulations. What you can do to save this, perhaps, is to remove what most people are commenting about as biomass. Right. Remove that entirely from these regulations, or there will be a legal challenge to these terrible regulations if they're passed the way they are. They're meaningless. There are standards in here. There's no monitoring. There's no enforcement. Uh-huh. Remove forest-derived woody biomass from the APS standard. You're not ready to implement this. These regulations are not ready for prime time. Finally, if you don't, we will see you in court. I guarantee you.
Rod Setkovich.
I'll take a pass.
Okay. Jim Kelly.
I am Jim Kelly from Sheffield. I have the blessing of being the current family steward on 300 acres of forest land out there. The house in my lifetime has gone from a coal-fired heating system to an oil system, and it currently uses a wood gasification system. We are not living in a world of black and white. We have gray issues. We see improvements. We see changes. I do not go out and select the trees that I cut for my wood heat simply to cut a tree to burn. I, in stewardship of this property, I used to be having area farmers that would maintain fields, field edges. It's now my responsibility so that the wood that goes into my heating system is a byproduct of maintaining the forest habitat and field habitat that I have. I have also used outside loggers because it's beyond my scope to handle 300 acres. And based on the tree selections that I have done, Mass Audubon came through and did a BIRD assessment on my property and gave me rave reviews. Again, as you look out and drive home, you'll notice that the vast majority of our forest habitat is in that mature age group, and the bird species and animal species that are required for the shrub young forest habitat on decline throughout New England, in particular Massachusetts. In recognition of that, by creating early succession of forest habitats and allowing those to grow up and become mature forests, and doing that in a matrix over my property, I am creating habitat. And whether or not this regulation goes through in favor of these, those trees in that matrix, I feel a personal responsibility to maintain. And I have been doing it for the last 35 years and will continue to do it as long as I am able. Allowing these regulations with careful thought, we can see that there are changes in the environment, but I do not. Sustainable forestry. I had a developer come and wanted to buy 100 of our acres and put houses up. That's not sustainable. I see the fracking going on in areas, and I see the gas pipelines coming through, and they're cutting down the forest for that. That is not sustainable. Sustainable forestry is allowing the trees to grow back, not putting another thing there, not paving it over for driveways. I am also a consulting forester. I have a bachelor's of science degree in forest management. in that I know the difference in the carbon cycles between the plants and animals and the water cycle that we have and the carbon cycle that involves the fossil fuels. So again, this is an area that's not black or white, it's gray, but these regulations go towards addressing that and opening it up to possibilities and recognizing life is complex. We deal with invasive species, invasive insects, and that all affects the forest health that I have to deal with on both a professional basis and on a personal basis.
Charlie Peck.
Hi, I'm Charlie Peck from Springfield, and I've been in Massachusetts my whole life, and I used to work for the community support program in Holyoke, and I have a story about particulates. I was an outreach worker, and I got a call one day from a social worker, and she said there's a child in Chicopee that's kind of a poor section of Chicopee was having asthma problems, and if she didn't get air conditioning pretty soon, they didn't know what would happen. So I did what I always did. I called my boss, and I said, we need an air conditioner in Chicopee. And he said, well, okay, we'll put it in the system and see how it'll go. And so after a couple of days, I checked back with him, and sure enough, it was in the system, and there was an air conditioner coming. But the little girl was particularly sensitive to these particulates that are in the air. And she died. And I couldn't believe it. You know, like someone died because they couldn't get air conditioning. And I was really, like, sad about it, you know. And it, this is 15 years ago, but I wasn't as up on these issues as I am now. And it was just like, wow, a little kid died because the air was bad? And then it happened again about 3 days later. It was a little boy. And it was like, God, I just couldn't believe that that was happening. So these are serious issues. I mean, the particulates in the air kill people. And I think that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Charlie Knight.
Yes. I'll stand from here so I have an opportunity to see the clock and maybe don't move. I started in learning about environmental technology at Berkshire Community College and received one of the first associates in the state there. I grew up with burning wood to keep warm. Then I learned some stuff. A tree takes carbon dioxide out of the air. And its byproduct that it doesn't want is oxygen. And as we reduce the number of trees around, we reduce the ability to take the stuff we don't want out of the air and put clean oxygen in. So clear cutting is no good. And I looked at a house that I want to rehab. And my architect asked me, why are you talking about vinyl windows? Why are you concerned? And I said, I want to keep warm. And he said, why don't you do it the way your great-grandfather did? They put internal shutters. They had curtains. They closed off the window at night so that the heat didn't go out. This year, I put two layers of 6 mil plastic on my windows in the apartment I live in. I didn't turn the heat on once this year. Yeah, it was cold one day. It got down to 68. But I was fine. Maybe what most of us need to do is change our lifestyle so we are not burning anything to keep warm. Maybe what we need to do is change our meeting times so they're not at night. Maybe a lifestyle needs to be changed. But most certainly, we don't need to give credit to help people to burn stuff we don't need to burn. We've had four or five people here talk about the health issues. I know from a little bit of research, 1 minute, thank you. I know from a little bit of research in Cairo, New York, you can go by that you can barely see it, a picture where somebody had carved his statue, his face on the hillside. He was a logger. And he was very proud of what he did. However, they had all sorts of sicknesses and problems there because they cut everything down. I think all I want to say is we need to be certain of what we put into the air that our little kids breathe, so we don't have any more dye from the particulates in the air. Two is too much.
Yep. Bill Copeland?
Thank you for the hearing and thank you for listening. My name is Bill Copeland. I'm a practicing pediatrician and I'm a Ford landowner in Northfield. I have a graduate degrees in ecology and public health as well. I'm here to argue against this subsidy for biomass. For three reasons. Forests grow back when they are cut, but essential minerals removed in the process are gone for good, and the amounts are significant. 300 pounds per acre of calcium is lost in a mature second growth harvest, and it takes 100 years of weathering to replace it. With our regional history of repeated deforestation and 50 years of acid rain, the forest soils of New England are already nutrient depleted. This is interesting because there's science, a growing body of evidence that calcium not only is a central nutrient, but it is involved in the stress response of plants. And the resilience of our forests actually depends upon the availability of calcium. People have commented on the toxicity of wood smoke. I would just add that the PM2.5, look it up if you're not sure, it's 2.5 microns. These particles go deep. They go all the way deep into the lungs. They're inside your body. They cause inflammation, which is a common pathway for lung disease, heart disease. So, not a good deal. Using biomass energy worsens climate change. A key understanding to emerge from the 2010 Manomet study commissioned by the DOER is that biomass burning always generates a carbon debt. Under stringent and optimistic scenarios, it may pay this debt, and a dividend happens after two or three decades. In reality, such a dividend has never been demonstrated, and considering that reductions in soil fertility are proportional to harvest intensity, they never will. Not with biomass harvesting, not in New England, and not in a time frame that is meaningful. The report acknowledges that the magnitude and timing of the debts and dividends are, quote, sensitive to how landowners decide to manage their forests. So what's a subsidy going to do about this? Using the most careful possible language and avoiding policy recommendations as they were instructed to do, they propose four options, quote, that the state may wish to consider if it determines that further actions are needed to protect public values at the landscape scale. Here, I am paraphrasing. Tell everybody to be sustainable and just see what happens. Two, make the foresters do paperwork about sustainable practices. Three, make energy plants do paperwork about sustainable practices. Four, formalize a way for everybody to prove they are being sustainable with paperwork. That's a lot of trees right there. The very up-to-date and authoritative Chatham House report from the United Kingdom 6 months ago is more direct. Quote, the provision of financial or regulatory support to biomass energy on the grounds of its contributing to mitigating climate change should be limited only to those feedstocks that had reduced carbon emissions over the short term. This would disqualify any harvest of high-nutrient, low-value biomass from a logging operation. Leadership can sometimes be simple. And Massachusetts has a history of leadership on the energy sector, increasing efficiency, increasing renewable use, and we should do this now, not subsidize.
Okay. Marty, Nathan?
I'm a family physician in the Brightwood North End, which has one of the highest asthma rates and childhood asthma rates, and also is one of the most impoverished areas in Massachusetts.
I'm a mother and I'm a grandmother, and I write about climate change, and I know something about that. I'm going to be very brief. Right now in this country, we are facing a climate catastrophe. And in Washington, all support for the transition that we need to make to true renewable and clean energy has been withdrawn. Therefore, we rely on the state. And for the state, DOER, to take its limited support for true renewable and clean energy and give it to the burning of woody biomass, to incentivize that instead of incentivizing solar, further incentivizing and supporting solar, wind, and geothermal, all of which we know will help to fight climate change, means that Massachusetts is criminally redirecting its energies, in quotes, and attention to an area that will not benefit any of us. I ask you on behalf of my patients, I ask you on behalf of the climate to please not do what you're planning on doing. Thank you.
Derek Mason.
Thank you. My name is Derek Mason. I'm from Moss Hill Farm out in Russell. Moss Hill is a farm that my family has owned and operated for three, going on four generations now. We are mostly a 300-acre tree farm. I am active on my town's finance committee and several other regional and community-based organizations focusing on economic and community environmental concerns. I believe I can speak for my extended family, my parents who have now died, and future generations, as well as for many citizens in my rural community. Like most of rural Massachusetts, which is most of the geographic area of our Commonwealth, we're dealing with some big problems around sustainability. I'm referring to declines in our rural population, our jobs, our economics, our tax bases, and our municipal revenues, and public services, our quality of life, school systems, and more. Meanwhile, the divide between rural and urban lifestyles and basic comprehension, appropriate public policies, regulation, and public services grows. Out here in rural Massachusetts, we see mostly wealthy city folks and ivory tower urban policymakers and academics as sadly ignorant of our problems and needs. We love and revere our beautiful green countryside, and we will protect it with all our strength. At the same time, we must have the tools and systems and regulations that allow us to access and use our natural resources wisely as a sustainable economic base. Out here, our taxpayers, our entrepreneurs, our town officials, our community service agencies, our legislators know this stuff. Speaking specifically about forestry, for many years, we have practiced, advocated, and struggled to improve our forest management practices and regulations. Once again, we ask that the Commonwealth work with our landowners and tree farmers, our professional foresters, and our timber harvesters to encourage better use of our lowest grade trees and encourage the removal of trash biomass for fuel. This low-grade forest resource is plentiful, renewable, and sustainable. And it is environmentally correct. It is what our forest improvement and our rural economy all need. Let me just say that my family of dedicated tree farmers owns a beautiful piece of undeveloped open space and forest land. We want passionately to keep it that way. The regs and management tools that you provide or will provide to support or undermine us will be key to our future efforts or our sellout. you will influence our decisions about the economic viability of our 300-acre farm, affecting our region's economy and our entire state's open space. Please help us and work wisely. Thank you.
So changing gears a little bit here, the APS is a diverse portfolio, so I'm going to be talking about air source heat pumps and water source heat pumps. I'm Joe Sheffley, a mechanical engineer with Mitsubishi Electric, a manufacturer of high-efficiency air source and water source heat pump systems, capable of producing heat at 3, 4, or 5 times the efficiency of electric resistance heating. We applaud the DOER for adding air source heat pump systems to the APS, since they source their air from heat that's in the outside air, much as ground source heat pump systems source their heat from the ground. We applaud adding this technology when historically it's only been ground source. We have submitted written comments in advance, so today I'll just touch on some of the key components of our feedback to help ensure that the APS is successful in its implementation. In general, high-level comments, the criteria in the current draft is, in some regards, overly restrictive, and so the only thing worse than having the program go through and be implemented is to have a low success rate in the program, low participation rate. So this feedback is really just in regards to having better market acceptance and better program participation by homeowners and is all the way up to commercial properties. The air source heat pump categories are divided into 3 basic categories. There's small, there's intermediate, and there's large. In the small category, to give an example of this, there's a current restriction in there where the equipment is to be sized for 50% of the current heating system size. So that means in your home, you are going to take this system that has to be a minimum of 50% of what your furnace or whatever it is that you have as a heating source in your home. Well, that's assuming that they properly sized your furnace 20 years ago when you bought that furnace. So maybe change that language to 50% of your design heating load. Make someone actually do a heating load calculation and only get the equipment you need in order to heat your home properly. The other thing is the percentage or the size of the system really that important? I would argue that just give less aches, but allow this technology to have greater market acceptance. So, for example, if you take an average across the U.S. or the Northeast here, you've got about a 5-ton heating load, your design heating load. So that means you've got to do 1.5 tons as your system size. You've got to do 2.5 tons as your minimum system size to qualify. Well, the majority of systems are much smaller than that, so you're going to have low program acceptance now if you have that criteria in there. So consider just using a lower ache multiplier. But still leave those smaller systems in the portfolio acceptable. In the intermediate category, no real feedback. That's great. It looks like that's going to be very successful with the current language, the way it's written. And then transitioning to the large category, currently simplification really needs to be the long-term goal here. Historically, custom utility programs have had poor program participation as a result of their complexity, and that's kind of the situation we have here now with large or VRF, variable refrigerant flow, air source heat pump systems. What they're looking to do is kind of like with a ground source system where you look at the amount of water that's flowing and the temperature differential in and out, you know how much heat was delivered. Well, you can't really do that with refrigerant and air source heat pump systems. The problem is you can't measure the flow rate. Those meters that are for measuring the flow, they're meant for a laboratory setup for compliance testing, regulatory, that sort of thing. Not practical to use in the field. And then the other half of it is the temperature measurement. The refrigerant in and the refrigerant out, you can't measure refrigerant like water because there's a phase change, and all of the energy comes from the phase change side of things. So just looking at some of the nitty-gritty details will really, I think, improve program participation. Thank you.
Charlie Carey, I believe.
I've been in the industrial wood energy business for 31 years, selling wood-fired boilers into the forest products industry, primarily burning forest residue. And what amazes me is the amount of forest residue that is available. And like Worcester, they took 30,000 trees out of the city of Worcester for the Asian longhorn beetle. I asked people who are opposed to burning wood, what is the highest and best use for that resource? Yeah, there are, I mean, there's no question there's a gray area here with particulates. But the fact of the matter is that New England and New York has decreased its particulate, ambient particulate rate by 40% over the last 15 years, primarily because the public sector has been way out ahead of a lot of emissions. I mean, you all drove here, and that puts out particulate emissions. When it comes to wood heating, the regulations over the last 15 years have increased the cost of putting a wood burner out there exponentially. And to hear people talk about, you know, the problems associated with wood burning when, you know, 100 years ago, everybody burned with wood. We clear-cut all the forests. We are so much further ahead of where we are now. I mean, where we were then. It seems to me that we have to ask the question, what is the highest and best use for available wood? And we can all argue about what available wood is, but there's an awful lot of wood dying in the forest right now because it is not well managed. There's an awful lot of invasive species going on out there. There's an awful lot of habitat being lost because we are not managing forests properly. If you want to get your habitat back, if you want your forest to be healthy, you need markets for wood residue. And I would ask anybody who is against the concept of burning it in these highly efficient systems, what is a better use for this resource? Is it leaving it on the ground to rot? Is it letting the trees all
fall?
Really?
Sir, could you address that?
Address us, please?
Yeah.
We're not having a debate.
It's a really interesting question because, you can, I mean, 30,000 trees in the city of Worcester, what are you going to do with them? And that's happening in a lot of places. So, I think from my standpoint, the regulations really come down hard on our chips and kind of over-regulating sort of the size and moisture content and the ash content. We really ought to be looking at sort of what comes out the stack and how the forests are managed. And right now, the forests are managed really, really well, really stringently in the state, and the emissions are leading the area, which is why we don't have much wood burning in the state. Thank you.
Ralph Baker.
Good afternoon. I'm Ralph Baker. I'm a resident of Fitchburg, a rural resident of Fitchburg, I should add. And I have a PhD in environmental science, almost 40 years of experience working in the private sector in waste management. Biomass should not be considered a greenhouse gas neutral type of source of energy, and we should not be subsidizing it. I believe we should remove biomass from the standards.
Yes.
My main concern is the incredible urgency of dealing with global warming and rising greenhouse gases. We urgently need to be moving to non-combustion, truly renewable sources of energy such as solar, wind, and geothermal. I've personally invested at my home in solar and geothermal, and I drove here in an electric car powered by solar, and I would encourage others to do that. Here in Massachusetts, we're not meeting the Global Warming Solutions Act standards. And that's really a serious problem, as others have said. The proposed standards violate our need to get to those requirements that are in the Global Warming Solutions Act. Our forests are, fortunately, one of the main components of our biosphere that can help us mitigate against climate change. By sequestering carbon, not only in the standing biomass, but also in the soil. About half the sequestered carbon is in the soil. And I've recognized from my own personal experience that typical sustainable forestry practices that are carried out in my area tend to remove a large portion of the standing biomass, say 50%, it's not uncommon, opening up the forest floor, causing drying out and mineralization of a lot of the soil organic matter, and that is takes a long time to get replaced, not to mention, as people have said, the decades that are required to regrow the trees. And I should add that older trees sequester far more carbon than the younger trees that replace them. This is new science, and it's in violation of or stands against what a lot of foresters were taught. Logging, even when it doesn't involve clear cutting, degrades this capability of the forest to sequester carbon. So I believe that climate change is a game changer, and we must begin now to view our forests differently and preserve them whenever possible, and find other uses, beneficial uses of those trees that do need to be removed from time to time. So I urge you to eliminate biomass from being considered as a renewable energy source.
Yep.
If I get this one wrong. Zerday Hudson?
Hi, my name is Sarita Hudson. I am the director of the Pioneer Valley Asthma Coalition, and I work for Partners for a Healthier Community, which is a public health institute in Western Massachusetts. And I'm here today to echo what everyone is saying about the health impact of biomass. And so I don't need to repeat all of the data, but it's we have an asthma crisis in Western Mass, and polio, one-third of kids that's have asthma in Springfield. 20% of kids and adults have asthma. So we are feeling the impacts in kids not showing up to school and parents not being able to go to work. And so we are living with very serious asthma outcomes, and we need to be thinking about how do we reduce their exposure to asthmogens and to air pollution, and not encouraging any kind of policy that would increase particulate matter in the air. So we can talk about what are the health impacts, but other people have already spoken to cancer, to asthma, Alzheimer's, ADHD, small lungs, and children who are premature births, children whose lungs never develop fully because of exposure to air pollution. We can talk about how wood smoke may be more harmful than other sources of air pollution. Just the impact particularly on low-income, environmental justice communities, on people of color who have more health impacts and suffer from health inequities. So we want to be thinking about if we're going to support and offer incentives, we want to be doing it to those kinds of energy production that will not have the same negative health impact. So given the time, and then of course there's climate change, and we want to be thinking about all of the health impacts around climate change, the increase in temperature and heat waves, the flooding, extreme weather conditions that can happen, the mental health impacts that can come from all of these extreme weather events, so all of the health impacts that are around climate change that are related to air pollution. So I will submit some written testimony, but I just want to echo what everyone else is saying about the public health impacts and encourage you to really think about all of the alternatives that don't have that air pollution. Thank you.
Joelle Million.
My name
is Joelle Million. I'm from Longmeadow, and I'm here representing the Springfield Area Interfaith Climate Action Network, which has members in 17 different faith communities in the greater Springfield area. We strongly oppose classifying burning biomass as clean energy. Technically, perhaps it's renewable in the long term, but the state of Massachusetts and its Global Warming Solutions Act has committed to reducing carbon in the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, burning any carbon-containing substance, whether biomass or fossil fuels, releases carbon into the atmosphere. Burning forest biomass to make electricity releases substantially more carbon dioxide per unit of electricity generated than does coal. If, as a state, we are truly committed to the benchmarks put written into the Global Warming Solutions Act, then even though DOER is tasked with and responsible for finding sources of energy to meet our energy needs in this state that are economical, you should also put into that not only economical but health-related. Given that responsibility, if as a state agency you're also committed to reducing carbon emissions, then biomass shouldn't even be in the mix. Shouldn't
even be considering it. All right.
Thank you. Yep. Next,
John Scanlon.
Hello, I'm John Scanlon, the Habitat Program Supervisor for the Massachusetts Division of Fisheries and Wildlife. Appreciate the opportunity to participate in the public hearing today. It's a little ironic for me to be here because I became a forester 47 years ago because I didn't get along with people all that well. I just wanted to work in the woods by myself and never have to deal with people. And career has turned out to be anything but that, but it's all good. You know, when we leave here today, there's going to be a lot of divided opinions, but I like to start with what we can get consensus on, all right? And what I've heard from everybody in this room today, all right, is that forests are a good thing, okay? All right? So we can, let's keep as much forest in as forest as we can, and then we have lots of opportunity to debate about what we do with it, okay, and continue to and go down that road. But to do that, to keep forest land in forest use, private forest landowners need some assistance. Now, whether it's some component of wood-based energy, whether it's tax policy, whatever, if you, as you sit here today, favor retaining forest land in forest use, don't turn a blind eye to the fact that private forest landowners are up against it with development pressure. They need a way to make their forest land economically viable to keep as forest. Right? One of the things I do for my agency, besides habitat management for rare and declining species, is to active with our land acquisition. And I see it all the time. Right? It's an age-old problem, all right, of being, you know, land-rich, cash-poor. Yeah. And a lot of land gets developed not because people want to see it develop, but because it's just they have no economic incentive to keep their land in forest use, which, of course, provides great wildlife habitat as well. Mass Wildlife has already submitted formal written comments, okay, so I'm not going to get into those now. I'll let you folks, the matter of public record, so encourage you to take a look at them. We do need to remove a lot of wood during during our habitat management for rare and declining species. And it's nice to have some outlet for it, but certainly understand that it should be locally driven consensus on how that's used. Thank you.
Next up, Howard Peterson.
First time I come before you. My name is Howard Peterson, president of Peterson Oil. We're a fourth generation energy distribution company in Massachusetts. And as you all know, I have a degree in mechanical engineering and I'm a voting member of ASTM, that is a well known testing and quality criteria. Our comments today are about biodiesel, and my written comments are more technical in nature, so I won't go into them. Detail, but they're in my written comments. We support the idea of using liquid biofuels. It's an alternative energy that's here. It's now. It's technologically able to be scaled. We agree with your definition of using feedstocks from waste energy. It not only takes waste out of our landfills, but it has a 80% or greater greenhouse gas life cycle emissions, which meets or exceeds your goals all the way to 2050. I do agree with the definitions that you've formulated on how to justify or make up your suppliers list. I'm not quite sure about the quality assurance program. As a member of ASTM, I'm not sure the government is the best quality assurance program you could make. There are other areas where there are areas like in audit control that the government does very good, but I'm not sure that quality testing is the main feed. I've never had anybody ask me, what does the government think about their new iPhone? So for the quality assurance program for the suppliers, I'm not quite sure that that's a necessary component, and the audit stream you can get from others. I'm not sure of the audit stream for a distributor like myself, the chain of custody. These are technical issues of how they would become noted. But I do know is that biofuels also have an immediate impact on greenhouse gas emissions of Massachusetts. It's here. It's now. It can bridge gaps to when other technologies become developed in the future. I know that our industry will share the lion's share of these attributes with the combined heat and power group, but those plants have yet to be built. And as you look at the percentage that is allocated to biofuels that are ready to be used in combined heat and power fuels, will be done. So I thank you for your time. I appreciate your considerations, and I submitted my written comments. Thank you.
Do you want to? Yeah, sure. Do you want one of everybody? David Morin.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the administration having this opportunity for me to talk. I applaud everyone that used the notes because I'm going to use them. I can't talk just like this. I have to use notes. I live in Worcester. I'm past president and current board of directors of the Worcester County League of Sportsmen's Clubs, an umbrella organization. We represent about 45 clubs in Worcester County, probably 30,000 members. Many of the clubs have wood lots. A lot of the members have their own private wood lots. The Worcester County League has 100 acres out in New Braintree, and we manage that. And I'm going to give you a quick little story here that was written about us, and I'm going to take a few minutes. In 2011, wanting to manage the property for wildlife habitat and recreation, we hired a certified forester. who immediately went to work. His first actions involved completing a comprehensive inventory of the property's natural resources, establishing management objectives, and funded by a Department of Conservation and Recreation grant, developing a forest stewardship plan. Other steps included locating, glazing, and painting land boundaries and preparing a timber sale. Jim DeMaio, who is a forester, he assisted Worcester County with enrolling their property in Chapter 61 program for forest taxation status. We have DCR, Forest Stewardship Council, Green Certification Program, and helped secure a federal Natural Resource Conservation Service Equipped Habitat Management Grant. In 2016, fulfilling our desire for both permanent land protection and public access, we acquired a conservation restriction on the property, which abuts the agency's 535-acre Wunnemusset Wildlife Management Area. Now into the future, we have sustainable management practices benefiting the swamp-listed species such as rough grouse, American woodcock, black bear, and chestnut-sided warbler, as well as other upland game and non-game wildlife, which will continue in coordination with Mass Wildlife Forestry staff. And what we did in the forestry practices, we left the important trees for wildlife. We took out the secondary wood that was not viable for wildlife, and we made brush piles, drumming logs for grouse, and now it's a 10-year program, and it's going to renew itself every 10 years, and we make that a model for other agencies, other clubs to look at our property. And the wood that came out of it probably went for biomass, and we apply your regulations, and we hope to work in the future. Thank you.
Peter Rayton.
Hi, I'm Peter Rayton. I live in Northampton. I have been a conservationist and an ecologist and a preservationist for pretty close to 40 years. I've been a timber harvester for about 40 years. And I say that I'm a preservationist because I'm also a grandfather, and I want to leave something for my kids, my kids, and my grandkids. So I'm proud of the work that I do, and I'm proud that I create something every day that people use. The wood that I'm standing on, the wood that we're surrounded by, the flooring and the trim boards over here. So I want to leave something behind. I'm not interested in clear cutting, and I'm trying to say that I do think that I also want to use everything that I have to cut down. I want to use as much of it as I can. So I do think that the biomass, the proposal to increase or make available the use of biomass for thermal and electric generation is a good thing. I also like to grow things. And that's what I feel like I'm doing in my everyday activity. If I'm encouraged to remove more of the weed species so that I can grow for future people, it's not going to be me that's going to benefit from the hopefully higher quality trees that I leave behind. I don't know, I get a great deal of pleasure out of that. The other thing, and I see a lot of people touching about climate change, and I absolutely am concerned about climate change. I like to ski. I like snow. And I see the fracking of natural gas. There's a lot of discussion about the benefits of natural gas. But what I see in natural gas is it requires injecting unknown substances into the ground, possibly potentially toxic substances. We really don't know what they put down there. So that's going into the groundwater, and water is essential to life on the earth. So I look at the benefits of biomass as being, it's not something that's it's not something underground that we can't see. It's a cycle that happens right in front of our eyes over perhaps 20, 30 years. And it's all new carbon, as one of the other speakers talked about. A long time ago, Carl Davies, a forester who I really respected, talked to me about old carbon from oil, millions of years old, and the new carbon that we have in our trees. So I know that my time's up. And thank you for holding this meeting out here in the East, in the West. Thank you.
I apologize if I get this one wrong. James Boulay, Bruce, I'm not sure.
Barabee.
Oh, Barabee. Okay, I see that now.
I don't want to repeat what Dave said a few minutes ago, but I'm Worcester County League of Sportsmen also. We have the clubs throughout Worcester County, and there's clubs throughout the entire state. One of our objectives is maintain open land, a green belt, and it's very important that regulations don't restrict forestry management. Most of our clubs do have forestry practices, Worcester County League. Matter of fact, Dave and I were instrumental in turning over part of the land for a conservation restriction just a year ago. One thing that I heard from the Mitsubishi, I can't say his company name, but I installed two heat pumps in my building just a year ago. We saved a lot of gas use by these heat pumps. I don't know how many people have them, but it's a great thing. All I want to say is the regulations that are there should not be restricting people who are doing practical forestry management practices. Thanks.
Stuart Warner.
Quick thing with heat pumps. I'm sure you thought that not only the heat load, but the cooling load would be part of that calculation, because that would make it more practical to incentivize, I would assume. But just referring to Mr. Scanlon, I think we all agree. Good forest management, keeping forests is incredibly important. I think the state has a role, a very complex role, to figure out how to do that, and they've done that with Chapter 61 and other land conservation. But I think it's something that can be better developed. It's also a question for voters and citizens en masse to perhaps address that directly, how to preserve our forests. But I don't think incentivizing the burning is the proper way to do it. I think this is sort of an inefficient, sideways attempt to support the importance of forests. So last thing I'd say is on a still winter night, I walk out. We have few neighbors in the neighborhood, but I walk out there and I can barely breathe sometimes. The smoke is very thick. And that's just four people. I think the collection of concentrating people who are burning wood can create real problems.
Leanne Warner?
I don't want to repeat what a lot of people have said here. I think it's been said beautifully. There's been a lot of great science and a lot of poignancy. One thing I do want to say is it's Monday and it's now 12:30. And I work And this took a lot of time and effort just to get here to make a statement that I would hope wouldn't have been necessary. There are a lot of people like me who couldn't get here. Most people do work. They have jobs. They're taking care of kids. They're taking care of sick parents. They're doing necessary chores. Now, I am here because I just need to make the statement that I don't want my clean energy dollars going to fund any energy that comes from a smokestack. We're at a point in time where we have to start thinking differently, being a lot more innovative. And these are our alternative energy dollars. And like I said, there are a lot of people like me. We just can't be here. People with vested interests can come. And they have the money to lobby you. But we don't. We're too busy and we're tired of having to do this. But I believe we are the majority. Okay? So please take that into consideration, that you represent everybody, not just people with vested interests that have the money to back them up. The only other thing I will speak about today is about PM2.5. I talked to an aerosol chemist at UMass. He described to me what it is, how small the micron size is, that you can't see them as individual particles. It's just a haze. But they're small enough because they're so small, they can go all the way into the deepest parts of your lungs. They cause respiratory illness, asthma, cardiovascular disease. There's evidence of the link to type 2 diabetes, to health diseases, incontrovertible now. And this is our alternative energy money we're talking about, going to fund something that's going to make people sicker at this point in time. Just to give you a sense of the PM2.5 we're talking about, the highest state-of-the-art boiler, okay, the highest state-of-the-art boiler puts out 830 times more PM2.5 emissions than natural gas. This is what we're talking about with our alternative energy dollars. So please don't do this.
The last person we have signed up for today is Mike Leonard.
Mike Leonard, Kentucky Forest Town for PSMF. I've been a product of the forest for decades. For years, I've designed and managed my widely acclaimed biomass improvement cuttings on thousands of acres of private forest land across the state. Biomass is the only real renewable energy and is, in essence, stored solar energy. It is a byproduct of our forestry operations, which allows us to grow more high-quality timber, which is the main product. In the last decade, major threats to our forests have grown. The most important are the hemlock woolly adelgid, with 2.3 billion board feet of hemlock timber is at risk, and the emerald ash borer, where almost 1 billion board feet of timber is at risk. This is almost 15% of all the saw timber in the state. Other insect and disease agents, the spread of non-native invasive plants, which crowd our native vegetation, and the legacy of destructive high-grade logging, where the best timber is cut, leaving a junk forest behind, have also caused our forests to decline. More than 75% of our forests have been degraded or are at risk for significant decline. Our forests are releasing as much as 3 million tons of CO2 every year as more trees decline and die, reducing net growth and decreasing carbon sequestration rates. As the hemlock woolly adelgid and emerald ash borer spread, it is going to get much worse. Hemlocks across the state are now in serious decline. To help meet emission reduction targets, our state is spending billions on solar and wind energy. The ability of these intermittent forms of energy to significantly reduce carbon emissions is questionable, since they all need natural gas as a backup. When the sun is not shining, the wind is not blowing. Not only that, the development of solar farms is now seen as one of the biggest threats to forests and farmland. These so-called solar farms are destroying valuable forest land. Zoning laws are also being ignored for these industrial projects. A solar farm in Orange destroyed rare habitat while another destroyed a beautiful viewshed along a scenic highway. These are only a few examples. This madness has to stop. My biomass improvement cuttings restore the health and productivity of our forests, while solar farms destroy the forest. Biomass plants produce ash as a waste product, which can be used as fertilizer on farms. Recycling old solar panels is going to cost more than it costs to install them, because they are toxic waste containing many poisonous materials. Finally, almost all of the solar panels are made in China, a lot with slave labor, while we produce all the biomass right here in America with American workers. So rather than wasting any more of our ratepayer taxpayer dollars in these destructive solar farms, we need to redirect these rec credits to clean, renewable biomass. We had good news recently from New Hampshire as SB 129 was enacted, which provides more support for the biomass plants there. I just want to say, right now, chip prices have fallen at 24 a ton, which is about the break-even price for an operator. We need at least $30 a ton to spur investment in our industry. We can easily support the harvest of 2 million tons of biomass a year, but what is the best-case scenario? An 80,000-ton wood pellet mill that would consume perhaps 160,000 tons? That would be only one-tenth of what's really needed, but it would be better than nothing. Our forests are declining and dying. The only way we can help restore the health and productivity of our forests is to support markets for low-grade timber, and that means biomass. Thank you.
At this point in time, the DOER is going to close the hearing. We thank everyone for coming today.
Thank you.
There's a comment.
On the signing sheet, can you just cross out there? Because what I spoke.
Oh, you weren't sure about that. Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. No problem.
Not a fake
self. What? Yourself.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep.
No.
They're kind of pro.
I'm
pro. We've got to maintain the habitat. I'm personally dealing with the results of stage one OHHs and pellet stoves and other things. What's coming out of this?